At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello, lovely listeners. It's Mel Barrett from the In Between podcast. You know, we dig into stories that don't sit right, the cases where justice feels incomplete. Well, I've got something new for you. Rebecca Lavoie from Crime Writers On and I are teaming up for a brand new show called Something's Off. Every week, we'll take on the cases that make you stop and say, wait, what? From current cases like the murder of Sandra Birchmore to the trial of Karen Reed to the Long Island serial killer and all the way back to the Menendez brothers, when the story doesn't add up, that's where we dig in.
I'm Rebecca Lavoie.
And I'm Mel Barrett, and this is Something's Off.
He still pressed her, and when he did, she was just like, come on. Like, that was her. It was just like, no, that's ridiculous.
It was exactly how one should respond when being challenged with something that either isn't true or is a distortion of the truth.
How much longer can this go on?
He said, how do you know there wasn't something under where his head landed? And she said, because I saw the photos.
She's not even telling the jury that he made a mistake.
So can we talk about this kind of like bombshelly thing that happened today?
Yeah, you want to talk about the x-rays?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a new tell today.
Where
and
he would repeat
hilarious.
Back the answer that they just said.
So the tell that I saw, he would ask her a yes or no question. Like he wanted a yes and she would go, no. And he would go, oh. he would just go, oh, you know, mathematical equations. How about the fact that he said there were no x-rays?
Correct.
He, too, is a liar. I mean,
either he was lying or Hank Brennan was lying. And Alan Jackson definitely intimated Hank Brennan has been lying to you. He said to her,
do you agree that a brain is very soft, consistent with, for example, tofu?
No, gross. No.
And then Bev said, I'll strike that. No comments.
Yeah.
Watch Something's Off with Mel Barrett and Rebecca Lavoie on YouTube and exclusively on Patreon starting mid-October. I'll leave you a link in the show notes. Before we begin the episode, I also want to give you a little trigger warning, I guess. I've had the flu for the past week, so my voice may be a little froggy in this episode. Please don't leave me one-star reviews over it. I promise it's temporary. But the show must go on, yeah? And these stories, they still need to be told. So without further ado, part two of the Savage Mountain Mystery with me and my froggy voice. Previously on The In-Between, a late night ritual on Savage Mountain ended in tragedy. Megan Schaefer survived a 30-foot fall and a frigid night in the woods, only to claim that her friend Alexander Stevens had slit his own throat. But Alex's autopsy told a different story, revealing multiple deep cuts to his neck. Injuries a medical examiner deemed impossible to be self-inflicted. Megan's shifting accounts raised more questions than answers. Now her freedom hangs in the balance as we turn to the courtroom and the quest for justice. On a crisp autumn day in 2018, the case of the state of Maryland versus Megan Virginia Schaefer began in the Garrett County Circuit Court. The small mountain community of Oakland, Maryland was swarmed by curious locals and media drawn in by the case's lurid details. Inside, the atmosphere was tense and hushed. Megan Schaefer, now 22, appeared pale and slight, a far cry from the vigorous karate instructor some remembered from before. She had spent the past year recovering from her injuries and awaiting trial, free on bond but shadowed by accusation. Now she took her place at the defense table, face to face with the possibility of decades in prison. From the very start, the autopsy findings took center stage. The prosecution, led by state's attorney Lisa Thayer Welch, wasted no time laying out the physical evidence that directly refuted Megan's story of an accidental fall and suicide. Jurors saw graphic photos, which left some visibly shaken, a grim necklace of gashes. Dr. Carol Allen, the assistant medical examiner, testified that the injuries were the result of 7 forceful sawing motions with a sharp blade. Allen's expert opinion, there was no way Alex could have done this to himself, not with injuries like this. She explained how Alex's fall had left him severely debilitated. Multiple broken ribs, a punctured lung, injuries that would have made self-inflicted throat cutting illogical, if not impossible, as she phrased it. To drive the point home, Dr. Allen demonstrated the path of the knife, each cut so deep it hit the vital arteries and even grazed his spine. As she spoke, she held her hand to her own neck and described the ferocity required to produce such wounds. Her testimony cast a long shadow of doubt over Megan's claims of Alex's suicide. The knife itself was shown to the jury, a plain kitchen knife, the kind you might take camping or use to cut fruit. It had been recovered next to Alex's body, stained with his blood. Forensic analysts reported that the knife handled had DNA from both Alex and Megan, which was not surprising, since Megan had told a medic her prints would be on it. The defense quickly pointed out that Megan had volunteered that information before she knew Alex's cause of death, suggesting her prints got there innocently, perhaps during the struggle or while attempting first aid. But to the prosecution, Megan's comment about the knife sounded less like foresight and more like consciousness of guilt. Why would an innocent person immediately worry about her fingerprints unless she held that knife in a critical moment? Meanwhile, the candles and the cat found at the scene became symbols imbued with mystery. Investigators testified about discovering 3 melted candle stubs and about rescuing the unharmed cat from its carrier. These facts weren't directly incriminating, but they painted a scene. The prosecutor posited a theory that Alex and Megan's candlelit cleansing ritual might have had a darker, possibly drug-fueled element, though toxicology reports showed no illicit substances in Megan's system, according to the evidence presented. One detective speculated that the ritual could have been a prelude to a suicide pact, that the two planned to die together in some spiritual or symbolic act. Perhaps he suggested they jumped from the cliff intending to end their lives, but when both survived the fall, the plan changed. Could it be that Alex then begged Megan to finish things, leading to the throat cutting? Or conversely, that Megan, spurred by motives unknown, took it upon herself to complete a ritual sacrifice? The prosecution floated these ideas not as fact, but to remind the jury how strange and singular this case was. There was an undercurrent of the uncanny that hung over the courtroom. The candles, the cat, the whispers of Wiccan-like ceremonies. But at the end of the day, the state's case remained grounded in the physical. Alex was dead by another person's hand. After laying out the forensic evidence, the prosecution walked the jury through Megan's own statements, using her words to tighten the noose. They played recordings of Megan's police interviews from the hospital. The jurors listened intently to the soft, halting voice of Megan just hours after the rescue. In the first recording, she sounded exhausted, intermittently sobbing as she describes the fall and insists, "Alex did this to himself. He cut his throat. I didn't hurt him." You can almost hear a pin drop in the courtroom as everyone listens. Then the tape of her second interview. Megan's tone more resolute, even defensive, repeating that she was 3 or 4 feet away when Alex allegedly slit his throat because he was tired of suffering. Finally, the third interview. Her voice is tense, higher pitched. She's now saying Alex pulled her off the cliff and forced her to hold the knife as he tried to kill himself. For the jury, hearing these 3 contradictory accounts back to back was powerful. Megan had told not one story, but 3, and they couldn't all be true. The defense, led by attorney Stephen R. Tully, had its work cut out for them. Tully's strategy was twofold: humanize Megan and introduce reasonable doubt about how Alex died. He began by contextualizing Megan's inconsistent statements. She had been found naked, half frozen, with a broken back, in shock when those interviews happened. Tully reminded the jury that Megan spent nearly a month in the hospital after that night, recovering from her spinal injury and hypothermia. The implication was that Megan's interviews were not calculated lies, but the confused recollections of a traumatized girl. To bolster this, the defense called a psychologist specializing in trauma, who testified generally that survivors of life-threatening events can have disordered memory and may change their account as memories return or as they try to make sense of what happened. Most critically, the defense presented their own expert, forensic pathologist Dr. Peter Gillespie, to challenge the state's autopsy conclusions. Dr. Gillespie agreed that Alex's throat was cut and that it was the cause of death, but he did not agree that Alex couldn't have done it himself. In fact, Gillespie testified that in his review, the pattern of wounds could fit a scenario where Alex's hand was guided by Megan's. He referenced specifically Megan's third statement, the one where she said Alex, while holding her hand, pulled the knife across his throat several times. He pointed out that the direction of the cuts, left to right, as on the body, could match Alex using his right hand over his throat or using Megan's right hand from in front of him. It was technical, somewhat speculative testimony, but the defense only needed to paint reasonable doubt. Gillespie disagreed with Dr. Allen's certainty. He noted that without an eyewitness, we must consider the possibility of a staged suicide. He also mentioned that Megan had no history of violence and it would be out of character for her to suddenly commit a gruesome murder like this. This was a crucial point for the defense, character and motive. Why would Megan kill Alex? The prosecution hinted at one possible motive, money. They introduced evidence that just days before his death, Alex had opened a transfer-on-death brokerage account naming Megan as beneficiary of $188,000. To the state, it looked like Alex might have been putting his affairs in order, perhaps in contemplation of suicide, or that Megan had manipulated him into signing over his funds and then eliminated him. However, Alex's father, Jay, had quickly obtained a court order freezing that account, so Megan never saw a cent. The defense argued that if money were Megan's motive, she certainly went about it oddly. She had no guarantee Alex would die in a fall or that she'd survive one. And if it was premeditated murder for profit, it was the most inept plan imaginable, one that almost killed Megan herself. Another angle emerged, the question of a suicide pact or coercion. Tully floated a theory that aligned with Megan's later statements. What if Alex had a suicidal intent all along? Perhaps Alex, despondent over his life's derailments, the Coast Guard expulsion, etc., had orchestrated this ritual as a final act. The candles, the cat, the beneficiary account. Evidence of a man putting things in order and saying goodbye in his own twisted way. This is where the allegations of possible abuse or manipulation came into play as well. In the weeks after Alex's death, Megan's story began to shift. Not just about what happened on the mountain, but about who Alexander Stevens really was. She claimed there had been warning signs, darker moments, things she hadn't told anyone before. One of those stories stood out above all others. She said that one night, while they were showering together, Alex took a razor blade and carved a cross into her back. She said the act was part of some kind of ritual, that he told her it was symbolic, a cleansing, a way of binding them together. According to her, she stayed under the water until the blood ran clear, while Alex poured alcohol directly into her cuts. The detail is shocking, visceral, and almost impossible to forget. It's also one of the most disputed pieces of the entire case. The claim surfaced later, after her arrest, and was never mentioned in Megan's initial police interviews or hospital statements. It appeared for the first time at trial, not from Megan's own testimony, but from a defense witness named Foy. Danielle Foy of Cumberland described Megan's relationship with Alex on the stand. Here's a voice actor reading from her testimony.
Their relationship was a little one-sided. I saw Megan cry because Alex needed her attention, which was unusual because Megan doesn't cry. Period.
Foy told the court that Alex had used a razor blade to carve that cross into Megan's skin. But under cross-examination, she admitted she had never actually seen the wound herself. And prosecutor Lisa Welch seized upon that immediately, pointing out that there were no photos, no medical records, no hospital notes describing any such injury on Megan's back. Nothing but Foy's testimony. If it happened, no one documented it. When first responders found Megan that morning, they described frostbite, bruising, and a broken back, but no mentions of cuts. If there had been a cross carved into her skin, it should have been visible, even to hospital staff. But none of them reported it. The state argued that the claim was an invention, one more attempt to paint Alex as violent or unstable, to justify Megan's actions that night. The defense, meanwhile, leaned on it as proof that Alex had been unpredictable, manipulative, possibly dangerous. It was a battle over narrative, a symbol of faith turned into a symbol of fear. In the end, the cross carving became a ghost story within the trial. Haunting, dramatic, but unproven. It was introduced as evidence of abuse, but it never solidified into that fact. No physical proof, no corroboration, no records outside of Megan's own words. The jury heard it, weighed it, and moved on. But like everything about this case, the image lingers. A cross, a shower, and a night that ended in blood. Whether that moment ever really happened, or whether it was part of a story Megan needed to believe, remains one of the strangest and most contested details of the Savage Mountain mystery. More on this after a short break. What about the candles and the cat? No occult expert was brought in to speculate on ritual meaning. The prosecution avoided feeding into any satanic panic or sensational motive. It served them better if this was seen as a straightforward murder. Similarly, the cat was simply evidence that Alex cared for his pet up until the end. And in case you're like me and wondering if the cat was okay after this ordeal, breathe easy, the cat was later given to Alex's family. Some in the press spun the cat's presence as chilling and almost sacrificial. But in court, it was treated with plain pragmatism. Alex lightly brought the cat because he didn't want to leave it behind if he was planning not to return. Perhaps one of the most poignant moments in the trial came from Jay Stevens, Alex's father, who was called by the prosecution. Jay's testimony was brief but heartfelt. He described his son as a kind, gentle soul who lost his way a bit after the academy but was finding purpose again. He spoke of Alex's new plans, possibly moving west, adopting another cat, studying different religions, all indicators that Alex was looking to the future, not planning an imminent suicide. Jay flatly rejected the idea that Alex would want to die or harm Megan. Jay's certainty that Alex wasn't suicidal bolstered the state's stance that Alex wouldn't have killed himself, and thus someone else, Megan, must have killed him. After 2 weeks of testimony, both sides presented closing arguments and the jury deliberated for many hours that stretched into the next day. In the end, they were not convinced by the defense's alternate theories. They returned a verdict of guilty on second-degree murder. Interestingly, the lesser charges, manslaughter and assisting suicide, were effectively rendered moot by the murder conviction. The state had charged them as alternatives, but the jury's murder verdict spoke decisively. Megan Schaefer was sentenced to 30 years in prison for the murder of Alex Stevens. When the verdict was read, Megan sobbed. Alex's family, stoic throughout the trial, quietly hugged one another. They had justice, at least by the measure of the law, but even they did not truly know what had happened on that mountain. Megan's defense team immediately filed an appeal, focusing on those hospital interviews. They argued that Megan was in no condition to waive her Miranda rights when troopers first questioned her, citing her pain medication and possibly misunderstanding that she had to talk to them in order to see her family. They claimed the first interview, the clear, concise one, was essentially coerced by circumstance. A hypothermic 21-year-old injured in the ER is not capable of truly voluntary consent, the appeal brief contended. They wanted all of Megan's statements thrown out as improperly obtained. If that were to happen, the backbone of the state's case, Megan's own contradictions, would be weakened. However, in 2019, the Maryland Court of Special Appeals upheld the conviction. The appellate judges reviewed the interview tapes and the suppression hearing. They noted that police were courteous, that Megan was alert and oriented, and that by her second and third statements, she had even met with family and still didn't ask for a lawyer. The court ruled that Megan's statements were voluntary and that the jury was entitled to weigh them. And with that, Megan's avenues for a new trial effectively closed, officially. But for those of us who have followed this story, and especially for those who knew Alex or Megan, the Savage Mountain mystery leaves lingering uncertainties. Let's grapple with a few of those lingering questions. Did Alex really intend a murder-suicide? Megan's third version suggests he might have. If true, it means Megan was a victim who became entangled in someone else's death wish. But there's no hard proof of this intent, only the ambiguous evidence of the candles, the cat, and the beneficiary account. Alex cannot speak for himself, and Megan's credibility is tarnished, and we are left to interpret symbols. Was the cat meant to be a companion in death, or just not to be left alone? Were the candles part of a peaceful ritual or a sinister rite? The jury evidently did not buy the murder-suicide narrative, but it remains a possibility that haunts this story's fringes. And why did Megan survive? If it was a pact, did she back out? One theory floated is that both jumped intending to die, but when they didn't, Alex insisted on finishing it, and Megan could not go through with it herself. Survivor's guilt and fear could have then driven her confusing behavior. Another theory is more nefarious, that Megan orchestrated the fall or pushed to kill Alex, hence second-degree murder, and was willing to risk injury to herself as part of the cover story. This latter theory is hard to swallow, I'll be honest. It's a big gamble to nearly kill yourself to get away with murder, and Megan's severe injuries argue against it being any clean plan. And then there's the third-person theory. Though no evidence ever emerged of a third party, locals have whispered about it. Could someone else have been out there? It seems far-fetched. There were no unidentified footprints, no DNA from others, and Megan never hinted at anyone else despite having every reason to if it were true. The third-person idea likely stems from the human tendency to fill gaps in the narratives. When a story doesn't make sense, we sometimes conjure an unseen character to explain it. In this case, the story makes so little sense that some feel someone else must have been involved. But absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, and vice versa. With nothing concrete pointing to another individual, we must accept that it was just the two of them on that mountain. In the end, the Megan Schaefer case leaves us with an unsettling truth. We might never know exactly what transpired on that cold January night in 2017. And in full transparency, as I mentioned before, I have spoken with Megan and her father, and they are not willing to go on record with the media just yet. I'm still holding out hope, though. The justice system did its best. The jurors weighed the evidence and delivered a verdict, yet there's a difference between a legal truth and an absolute truth. Megan's conviction answered the question of legal responsibility. The state held her responsible for Alex's death, but it did not, and maybe cannot, answer the deeper question of intent. Did Megan murder Alex in cold blood, or was she tangled up in a tragic pact beyond her control? Was she an evil actor or a panicked survivor who made poor choices after a horrific accident? The symbolic aspects of the case tantalize but don't resolve anything. Fire can symbolize cleansing or destruction. Were the candles lit to heal or to consecrate something dark? The cat could symbolize innocence or loyalty, or perhaps be nothing more than a practical concern for a pet's safety. The narratives we construct around these symbols often say more about our own need for meaning than about what truly happened. As an investigative podcaster and a fellow human being, I find myself empathizing with everyone involved. With Alex, who by all accounts was a bright young man grappling with guilt and issues from his past and searching for identity. And with Megan, whose life took a drastic turn from ordinary to nightmarish in one night, and who will likely ponder what if every day behind bars. Savage Mountain keeps its secrets. The rocky cliff at High Rock still juts out over the forest as it has for ages, indifferent to the human drama that unfolded there. Hikers pass through Savage River State Forest today, perhaps not even aware that it was the backdrop to such a tragedy. Sometimes they might notice wax drippings on a stone or a scuffed mark where something heavy fell. But nature has a way of reclaiming and erasing, covering history with moss and autumn leaves. The Megan Schaefer case challenges our desire for a clear narrative. It forces us to confront that not all mysteries can be fully solved, even with a conviction. It reminds us that human psychology is complex. Love and desperation can intertwine in lethal ways, and who's left behind are often torn between anger and compassion. As we close this two-part journey, we don't do so with absolute certainty about what happened, but rather with a deeper understanding of the questions and possibilities. The story of Megan Schaefer and Alexander Stevens is ultimately a cautionary tale about how easily truth can become caught between perspectives, between forensic evidence and human memory, between the known and the unknown. And the truth lies somewhere in the in-between. Thanks for listening. Be good people. Don't do murder. The In Between podcast is written, edited, and hosted by me, Mel Barrett, and is a production of Ruby Grace Productions. If you want ad-free exclusive content, bonuses, and lives, head on over to the In Between podcast Patreon and sign up. The researcher level starts at $6, and there's already 20-plus ad-free episodes for you to binge right now. Special thanks to Amber Hunt for editorial guidance, as well as the rest of the team at Grabbag Collab, Amanda Rossman, and Daisy Egan for their support and guidance. Another special thanks to Rebecca Lavoy for her friendship and mentorship. You can catch me and Rebecca recapping the Karen Reed trial on the Crime Writers On, The Readathon. Follow the In Between podcast on Blue Sky, Facebook, and YouTube at In Between Pod, and on Instagram at The In Between Pod Official. On TikTok, you can follow me at Jack of All Trades, DC.